Welcome to episode 18 of the Player One podcast for February 26, 2007. I'm your host, Greg Stewart, and with me this week is our regular guest host, Phil Theobald.
Hello.
That was a really disappointing intro, Phil.
Well, you know, I was trying to come up with something clever to say in the theme of today's show, but I couldn't think of any, so you'll have to forgive me.
All right. We have two people, tune in next week. We have two people missing on the show this week. Chris Johnston is currently away at the New York Comic Con, where he's pretending to know lots of stuff about anime, I guess.
Freaking nerd.
Yeah. Dan Dormer has gone looking for love in several wrong places, so he won't be with us this week. But we have a special setup. Phil and I actually had a chance to sit down and pick the brain of one Al Lowe.
Yeah, we were really excited to get a chance to talk to Al. He's one of the original employees at Sierra Online back in the early days of computer gaming, and he really is a legendary game designer. I know Greg and myself are huge fans of Leisure Suit Larry, which was Al's most famous creation while he was there.
Yeah, so he gave us a lot of his time. Let's head right into the interview.
Again, Al, thanks for agreeing to chat with us here.
It's my pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you. And yeah, we're definitely glad to have you here on the Player One podcast.
To be had.
Oh, well, double entendre intended, I guess.
Who, me?
Yeah, no, not you. Never. I guess, well, first of all, we were just kind of wondering about your life kind of pre-Sierra. Like, what got you into game development? What led you down that road?
Oh, I had the perfect background to become a game designer. I was a musician and a music major in college. Never took a course in programming. Tried never to take a math class, and taught public school music, was a high school band director for 10 years, and then spent 5 years as a music coordinator in a large school district. What would qualify you better to design games?
So now that, like, Britney Spears seems to be kind of dropping out of the music industry, she can maybe get a new start at programming or something?
I think Britney is equally as qualified as I to be a game designer.
Oh, come on, let's not say anything we can't take back.
Well, I think she and I have both learned over the years. But no, when I started, I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew that I loved playing games. I loved the kind of games that Sierra did. And I... My wife has just overheard me, and she came in and she said, "You and Brittany both have bald heads."
I was going to say the exact same thing, and I was avoiding it because I didn't know if I'd insult you or not.
No, I've looked in the mirror. It's true.
Speaking from one bald man to another.
And I'm on my way.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, there are worse things that could happen. Oh, shoot. What was I talking about anyway?
You were talking about how much you love Sierra games.
Yes.
Yeah, I played a lot of games, and I ended up running to create educational games. And because that was my background, I was in teaching. So we made some games that were educational and written at the, I think, second or third grade reading level that followed a format that later became point and click. In our games, it was actually move the cursor with the space bar and press the enter key to continue. So it was like you had a small choice of topics and things. But it was a very simple interface and a very simple game that kids could play. And through those games, which we self-published, we went on then to sell those at different shows, and I went to Applefest of 1982, which, good Lord, that's a quarter of a century ago.
Yeah, that's not recent.
But I'll remember it as if it were yesterday, because we set up this little 10-by-10-foot booth with a couple our own color monitors that we brought from home, and Ken and Roberta Williams came walking down the aisle, and Ken said, "Hey, Berta, look, these games look just like your games." It was like, well, that's where I was heading. That was what I was trying for. But we started a relationship with Sierra at that point, and they became my publisher. I got out of filling boxes and making, you know, designs, package designs, and shipping UPS packages and all that stuff, and instead went on to design more games. And I started off doing educational stuff because that was my background, but Sierra hit some tough times in the early 80s when they expanded into Atari cartridge games just as that market died. So there was one Friday, I guess when I went to work, I was like the 20th employee. That was in the summer, I suppose, of 83, summer of 83, I think I was employee number 20. And when everything went along pretty well until the returns started coming back after Christmas. And in the spring of 84, there was one Friday morning when Sierra had 120 employees, and that afternoon they had 40.
Wow.
They laid off two-thirds of the company. But, wow. And they had a lot of programmers who were employees, who were on staff, and the tack that they took was to kick everybody loose, but give them advances against royalties so that you would continue to have an income, you'd continue to be able to eat and things, but then you were responsible for bringing back the product, and then you would live off the royalties from it. Well, out of the 25 programmers that were on staff at that time, I think 22 of them went home and, you know, cut firewood or watch soap operas or smoke dope or something, but they certainly didn't come back with any code. Three of us did, and that was kind of the formation of the second round of Sierra, was those three guys that kind of restarted the company and built it again. Ken went back to programming. He and I worked on the Black Cauldron game in his game room at his house. In fact, I ended up staying with him for weeks on end just because we were working 18, 20-hour days. I'd just fall asleep and sleep on the sofa or something and get up, and we'd work again until we dropped. And that's the way we kind of put the company back together.
Wow. So the other two guys, the other two programmers that came back, would they be anybody that Sierra fans of old would recognize?
Chris Iden and Bob Heitman are the two that I'm thinking of. There may have been others, but those two guys were really key in turning that thing around. Jeff Stevenson, who developed the AGI language and the SCI language, both of them. Jeff was also around at that time, and he did yeoman work. I mean, he was an amazing guy, and as were, I mean, there were lots of other people, but I remember Chris and Bob and I spent a lot of nights and did a lot of work together. And this was about the same time that Scott and Mark were just getting going, you know, with Space Quest. And
yeah, the two guys from Andromeda.
Yeah, and they had a wonderful, it was a wonderful time because we really didn't have much to lose, and so the company could just try a lot of things because it wasn't afraid to lose millions and millions of dollars because the games that we were doing were small and quick and efficient, and, you know, it didn't take that much investment. So that's kind of the rebound of the company back then. And that was about, I think, 1984 or so is when it really started. And then Larry shipped 20 years ago, well, within a few months of now. It was the biggest flop the company had ever had.
Really?
Yeah, I think the first month it sold 4,000 copies.
Wow.
This is at a time when even bad games sold 40 or 50,000. And so I kind of went, oh, I screwed up there, didn't I? And ended up working on Police Quest with Jim Walls and getting that game done in time for Christmas. But it, because they never advertised Larry or spent a dime on marketing, I think they were afraid of what people would think of it. It just sold by word of mouth, and so it was the weirdest thing because I just kind of wrote it off as wasted, you know, time. But each month it continued to double in sales until after I'm actually looking at my wall, and the top 10 selling games of July 1988, it has Leisure Suit Larry at number 3 with a bullet going up. And and it's been on the chart for 24 weeks.
Jeez, nice.
So yeah, and yeah, I'm real happy that I have that on my wall because I actually programmed 3 of the 10 games on that list.
Wow,
that's impressive. King's Quest 3 was another one, and then Police Quest was also on there. So that was a unique moment.
That's pretty fantastic. I mean, and that's the kind of thing you don't really see nowadays. If you look at just on our last show, we looked at the top 10 selling games of last year, and you know, there's just to imagine that, you know, 3 of those games being, you know, with like one guy working on them, it's just something that would never happen these days.
No, it couldn't possibly.
No. Then. You were mentioning that Sierra didn't really spend any money marketing Larry when it first came out, and was there some sort of kind of trepidation when you came up with this idea for the game? Or
well, you could say that. let's see. I mean, we when we came up with the idea, it was fine. You got to understand, Larry was a rewrite in a way. I mean, it was a pretty severe rewrite, but there was a game in 1981, maybe, or 1980, called Soft Porn, and it was the only text-only game that Sierra ever sold. It was a very different time in that it had no central character at all. And its language was such that it was as if you were ordering the computer to do things, as opposed to current games where you have a protagonist on screen and you kind of think of yourself as that person and you move around doing these things. No, this was much more of, well, actually there was one line in it that I'll never forget that was so bad. the game would say, "I am your puppet master, I will do as you order me." And so it's like that was the attitude of it. It was really lame, and it was about a guy who was seriously trying to get laid, and you won if you got laid 3 times. So, I mean, it was...
Everybody wins if they get laid 3 times.
So we looked at that game in 1981. Well, when Sierra got the rights to the Disney characters, which people may not know, but when the Texas Instrument Company made its ill-fated venture into the computer game market, into the computer market, they thought the way to get sales was to spend tons and tons of money on spokespeople. So they hired Bill Cosby for millions of dollars to be their spokesperson. They spent tons of money on rights to the Disney characters, to all the Mattel characters, Barbie and everything. So they had this whole stable of things, and then they tried to sell computers and games made from those and failed miserably. So they went out of business. And Ken happened to know somebody at TI, and he picked up the rights to the Disney characters from them. And Sierra had the rights to all the Walt Disney characters for several years. Well, we wrote, I wrote Winnie the Pooh in the 100 Acre Woods, and Donald Duck's Playground, and and a bunch of those games that people can now download off my website if you don't tell anybody at Disney about it. But when Disney came along, they said, you know, we don't really think we should have Mickey Mouse and Winnie the Pooh in the same catalog as a game called Soft Porn. And everybody agreed and said, yeah, sure, okay, so we'll drop Soft Porn because its sales had gone away anyway. Well, after we lost the rights to the Disney characters, we were kicking around. We said, hey, maybe we should do a re-update of Soft Porn. It was the biggest selling game in history at that time, you know? And you have to understand, at a time when there were 100,000 apples in the world, Ken had sold 25,000 copies of this game. And everybody I knew had an illegal pirated version of it. So, I mean, it pretty much had market penetration of 100%. So, well, anyway, we said, well, maybe we should go look at that game and do a revision of it and, you know, put it in the modern 3D interpreter, which was AGI. So I took it home and played it, and it was like, oh, my God, this game is – I came back and reported to him. I said, you know, Ken, this game is so out of date it should be wearing a leisure suit. And he laughed. And I said, well, maybe that's an idea. I said, but I think if you let me make it funny, I think I could make fun of it, and that might work. And he said, sure, okay, try it. And that was literally the pitch. That was the design document, the treatment. That was it. It was like a conversation and go see what you can do. So that's what I did, and I didn't know anything about writing a funny game, so I just kind of threw stuff in it wherever I could. And the first thing I did was rewrite every line of dialogue and every line of description in the game, and the second thing I did was create a central character that was this guy in a leisure suit, because that was, you know, suitably out of touch with reality at that time. And so, you know, I've everything about the game is different except the puzzles, and I kept those so that we had some connection to, you know, the old game. So that's how it came about.
Wow, well, that's interesting that you kept the puzzles out of the old game. I didn't know that.
Yeah, if you download Soft Porn from allo.com. I should start plugging my website.
Yes,
you
do ahead.
I do the website plug all the time here. Yeah, if you download the game from allo.com, you can actually solve it using almost the same walkthrough as you would Larry, except, of course, the commands are all different. In fact, with the game, I include a complete walkthrough just because nobody would ever figure out how to play it in these days. I mean, it's pretty primitive. So,
so you mentioned before you got going on, Larry, with the Disney properties. They're still a hot commodity nowadays in the video game world, but you hear a lot of horror stories from people who work with Disney as far as how hard they are to deal with regarding those properties. Like, did you have to deal with anything like that, or was it pretty open-ended when you were doing the Disney games?
I believe the phrase that my wife and I have often traded is, the mouse plays hardball. One of the reasons that Ken wasn't interested in continuing the relationship was because they kept all the money.
Uh-huh.
It was a wonderful thing. Hey, you get a chance to create games, you know, with the Walt Disney characters. You don't get any money, but you get to create the games. It was like, wow, you know, and at the time, you got to understand, 25 years ago, the rights to the characters and things weren't as important as whether or not the game was really fun to play and was unique, was something people hadn't seen before, and geeks of the time didn't really care if you had a franchise. What they cared about was the you know, the reviews that it got. And
right.
So what we found was we could make more money doing games that were not with a franchise character, where we didn't give away the rights, the money to the franchise owner, but instead threw that into the game itself, and, you know, put a better quality game out, and didn't have the, maybe with the name recognition and that, but that was, that was really one of the strong reasons for, I think, the, for Leisure Suit Larry's success. When you asked what kind of marketing and sales it did a while ago, part of the reason I laughed, and I don't know if you heard that or not, but I laughed because when the game was ready to ship, Radio Shack was a third of Sierra's business then. Oh. They were the Walmart of the time. I mean, they had tremendous software departments, and they had knowledgeable people who, you know, really sold a lot of software. They moved a lot of goods, and I'm literally a third of the game sold from Sierra went through Radio Shack. Well, the Radio Shack guys took a look at Larry, and they said, "Oh my God, we can never get this past our CEO. He's a fundamentalist Christian. he'll have a heart attack if he hears about this game." So they didn't sell it. Well, immediately, I think that was a big cue to Sierra to say, "Well, this we went too far. The game's not right." But in reality, what happened was, because we didn't sell through Radio Shack, we got to keep much more of the money. And so I ended up making a lot more money because people had to pay, for the game, and they would buy it elsewhere, where we made a higher profit margin than through Radio Shack, where, we got to keep a few cents because they moved so much product. So
nice.
Yeah, same old deal.
Well, thank you, prudes.
Yep.
And for what it's worth, I played a embarrassing amount of Donald Duck's Playground back in the day.
Wow.
I loved Donald Duck's Playground. It was one of my favorite games.
So does it surprise you then that I'm a model railroader?
Not at all, actually. I did not know that was a I did not know that was a hobby of yours. But,
yeah, but that's one of the activities in Donald Duck, and
I certainly remember.
And of course, I lived in Fresno, which was in the heart of the fruit belt, and that's why there was the game where you had to sort out the various kinds of fruit. Remember that?
Fruit being thrown off the truck. I saw
you. Oh man!
Yeah. So I mean, it was all. There's a reason behind all those. Those weren't arbitrary choices,
So Donald Duck's Playground is surprisingly close to just being Al Lowe's Playground.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, Disney's input on it was, we need to have some meetings. And I would, by the time I'd get back to them, I would say, I'm just about finished. Oh, really? Well, no, we need to meet. All right, we'll get that scheduled. And then I'd go, here's the game, it's done. Oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, we have some suggestions. Well, it'll make us ship late. Oh, well, okay. That was a different time as well. You'd never get away with that today either.
Exactly.
But I think there's something about that that is maybe important to people, which is that it takes a visionary to create a product that has a sense of the whole to it. I mean, when you have games that are done by committees, it feels like it. I think you need somebody who can express, and somebody who's, a benevolent dictator who can, like Roberta Williams was, or like I was, that in that you create your vision for it. And then if you don't like that vision, well, at least it's a unified vision. You know what you're getting. Mm-hmm. But I think so many games try to be everything to everybody, and that just doesn't work.
Yeah, agreed. Another thing, kind of going back to something you talked about earlier, you obviously have a pretty huge background in music, and I know you composed a lot of music for the games. I know you did the Larry theme, and if I remember correctly, you did some music for Freddy Farkas.
Yeah, I wrote the theme to Freddy.
Now, was that kind of a common thing back then for to have kind of the main guy in charge of the project also do the music, or?
No, I think it was a strength that I had, and it was one less guy they had to pay.
Well, there you go.
That's the reason. Yeah. They'd have you shoving the discs in the boxes if they could.
Yeah, exactly.
That was more common back then, right? Like, what would you say the size of? Did you even have teams working on the games that you were working on, and how big would you say they were?
Larry 1 was done with a fairly small team, me.
There you go.
And I couldn't do the art. So Mark Crow created all the art during a month of weekends and evenings while he was working full-time on Space Quest during the day.
Oh, wow.
So one artist for 1 month of spare time, not full-time, just right. Evenings and weekends. And all the animation, he did all the animation, he did all the title screens, he did all the backgrounds, everything.
Wow.
Yeah. And part of it was we had no tools, you know. The tools that those games were created with were just incredibly primitive. I mean, when I tell people that, you know, they say, well, how'd you do the graphics in that? I say, well, you know, it was before Photoshop. They just look at you like, what? Before? What do you mean before Photoshop? It's like, no, there was no Photoshop. There was no graphics program that you could buy. What? What do you mean? There was. I mean, it just sounds insane, doesn't it? You know. Yeah, it was. But that's true. Bob Heitman, whom I mentioned earlier, created the tools that we used to make those things. He did the animation editor. He did the background editor, and all those AGI games were vector based. So, you know, drawing. It was not like a 3D CAD program. It was not like a paint program. It was much more of a, I'll draw a line. I'll start the line here. I'll draw the line to here.
Man.
Then I'll draw the line to here. Then I'll draw the line to here. Oh, look, I've made a box. I'll get the fill command. I'll fill that box with this color. Tink. And I mean, it was just that terrible. And that's the way those poor guys worked. So
wow.
Yeah. Times have changed.
Man. Now, you know, one thing about the early Larry games that I distinctly remember from playing them back in the day, because you know, I guess technically I shouldn't have been playing them back in the day.
guessing at the answers for the questions, yes, that opened the first game.
Yes.
Who's O.J. Simpson?
Yeah. Many hours spent doing that.
Yeah, was that and just to kind of...
And you never, ever pressed Alt-X, did you?
No, I actually read that trick on your website, and I felt like such a fool afterwards. Like, there was actually an easy way to get around that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just to fill in some of our listeners, in the early Larry games, when you started them, a series of questions, like trivia questions, would come up that you'd have to answer. And the questions were specifically written so that you'd only really know the answers if you were over, say, 18 or something like that. And yeah, like when I was a kid playing these games, it was you know, really difficult because, you know, we didn't have the internet. We couldn't just click Windows over to Wikipedia.
What? It was before the internet?
And you couldn't run and ask your parents because you weren't supposed to be playing that game to begin with.
Exactly. We couldn't. You know, who's Lyndon Johnson, Mom?
I actually got a wonderful email from a guy who said that it brought a whole new meaning to their dinner time conversation. Because he every night he would ask like one question. And they were going, what? How did you get interested in politics?
Because now those questions, was that just something that you came up with, or was that like actually something that like Sierra mandated to kind of keep kids from playing them? Or,
well, Ken suggested that. He was a big Trivial Pursuit buff. Trivial Pursuit was just coming out at that time, and he was a big buff, and they loved that game. And so he said, well, maybe we should have some, you know, way to keep kids out just to make sure. And I said, well, I don't think Trivia will do it. They'll figure it out. But I said, sure, let's do it. It'll be fun. So that was it. We just came up with a question. And those questions are all on allo.com right now.
Yeah, I was actually looking through some of them, and yeah, I noticed the slightly foreboding O.J. Simpson question.
Is that weird or what?
That is.
I swear to God, I just made those answers up.
That's so funny.
As I was writing things, and of all the things to pick, well, of course, it's still not true, so I guess.
Yeah. O.J. Simpson is A, an R&B singer, B, under indictment.
Not C, yet.
C, embarrassed by his first name, Olivia, or D, which is the correct answer, no one to fool with,
yeah.
Which, quite frankly, I still believe. So.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's probably true. So,
when you were working on Larry, I mean, that really pioneered the adult video game outside of soft porn. Did you feel like that was, like, have any inkling at all that that's what you were doing at the time, or was it just sort of a fun thing to do?
Well, I think the best part of it was that Ken encouraged all of us then to be true to ourselves and to do the kind of game that we would like to play. And I think that's what shows through, was that that's the kind of person I am. You can tell from my conversation here so far tonight, and you can tell from reading my website and stuff. I mean, I've always been a class clown. I've always been the guy telling jokes, the guy who, you know, I was the MC and ran the microphone, and when I played gigs, you know, I was just, I'm that guy. And so by allowing me to be that person in software, I just created a game that I wanted to play, and a game that I thought adults would enjoy playing. I never thought of it as a training ground for pubescence, you know, but I guess it turned into that. But you know, I had a son who was about that age. I think when Larry came out, he was about 11 or 12, and you know, I tried to put things in there that I figured he had seen on HBO or had seen at somebody else's house, you know, stuff. I tried not to make it so that it was a pornographic game, but rather it was just kind of like guys sitting around in the locker room, talk and behave, you know?
Right. And speaking of, you're saying you tried to make it so it was something that, you know, adolescents would be, they'd be fine with seeing, and that it wasn't really a pornographic game. How do you feel about, like, the industry's sort of taken it to the extreme with the M-rated games, like things like BMX XXX and that sort of thing? Like, do you think that's a good thing? Or?
You know, they, to me, poking fun at that is one thing. Taking it seriously is another. And I think that the closer they get to trying to be sexy, the farther away it becomes. I think that as long as you're spoofing people like that, you know, it took me a year in Germany, I guess, when I spoke with Germans, before I realized that they didn't get that Larry was a joke.
Really? Wow.
They were kind of thinking it was a serious, exercise in how to pick up women. And
it wasn't.
So I tried to. Oh, sorry. But I tried to make it so that it was more obvious then after that. This is called parody. You get it? But I think when you go seriously, it becomes you realize just what a bad medium computer games are for pornography. It looks terrible. You know, you can get, you can rent a video for $1 that looks lots better. You know, why would you waste $50 on a game like that? So I can't take it seriously. I guess that's my issue.
That's funny. Here's a question that I'm sure you've been asked probably a million times, and I've heard a million different answers about it. So now that we got you here, I want to hear your exact take on this. Why was there never a Larry 5? What is the real answer behind the jump?
Actually, there was a Larry 5. Oh, there was.
Did
there
I say five?
Yeah.
I meant four.
See, I've,
all credibility's lost.
Credibility That's gone. It. Yeah.
Okay, so shall we take a splice here, guys?
Yeah. Our technical director's listening. We need to redo this question.
Yeah.
So why was there never a
Larry four?
Well, the truth is that when I finished Larry 3, I thought it would be a trilogy. I thought that that was, I had milked it long enough and that that would be the end of it. And so at in order to make sure that happened, at the end of the game, I actually kind of tied it up and put a bow on it. You know, I didn't want it to go on. I wanted to get on and do other things. And to that end, Larry, actually, at the end of the game, falls out of the game and into the back lot at Sierra, where he runs through the set where they're filming Space Quest, and you become weightless and floating around, and it runs through the set where Roberta is trying to get you to climb the whale's tongue, because I hated that damn puzzle. and I forget what the police the police quest one was. The there were people underneath the table moving around little tiny cars in that driving scene. So I wanted to have fun with it. And of course, that was my kind of personal tribute to Blazing Saddles, which at the end of that film breaks out of the set and into the next sound studio where they're filming a Busby Berkeley musical number. So, I mean, that was just kind of my little take on, my humble take on, falling out of the game. But at the very end, the last scene of the game is Larry is sitting on this porch in the Sierra Mountains with Patty beside him and computer monitor in front of him, and he's actually typing the first lines of code from Larry 1. And he's saying, yeah, I'm going to start it all outside this bar named Lefty's. And then on the screen, you can see the actual code, which I copied from the old floppy disks from Larry 1. And that appears on screen, the source code. So I thought, well, this is a good way to end it. You know, he's come around, now he's going to tell his story in the first game. Well, you know, the sales went nuts. I mean, the game sold great. And so I went on to work on some other projects, one of which you can read about on outlo.com, where I invented the Internet.
Ah, yes.
Yes.
You and Al Gore.
Yes. Well, everyone named Al, I guess.
Yeah.
But we seriously started a online gaming division at Sierra called Constant Companion, which was actually my wife came up with the name, and was to be a place where you could always go and find somebody to play a game with. And it ended up being called the Sierra Network, and that was sold to AT&T and became the Imagination Network, and then that was sold to AOL, and it became Lost in Space, I think, or so. I don't know whatever happened to it. It was never seen nor heard from again. But anyway, that was the first online gaming network. That was like 1989, I guess, probably like that.
Wow.
So at that time, we literally had one guy who was writing the lowest level code you can imagine. He was reading the serial ports on the modems and storing that up as a data in for each of the modems, because we figured that each modem would have a separate presence on. So rather than using the technology that existed, which we didn't even know about, he just started from scratch and just started doing it. We said, well, okay, well, if we put six modems in a AT chassis, then we could put an expansion card in and loop that to a second chassis, and in there we could put six modems, and we could pick a card in there that went up to the next chassis, and we could put six more modems in. So we had a stack of like 24 modems, 1,200 baud modems inside these boxes. It was just insane. And we ran all these phone lines in, and we created this gaming network literally with modems and scotch tape. So that was going to be the next Larry. It was going to be, you know, Larry's multiplayer online adventure. Wow. Well, good Lord, were we crazy or what? You know, I mean, I worked on that game for months, and we just never could get even the basics working. So to test it, I wrote a game, a checkers game, and a chess game, and a backgammon game, and I'm trying maybe something else. And we also created the first avatar, the first representation of a player. We actually made a face maker that you could change the face and put on mustache or bald heads.
Amen.
Or you know, different clothing and all that kind of stuff. And turns out that we didn't. AOL later got a patent on that idea, and so now AOL owns the idea. The patent has patented the online avatar. Oh, is that a frightening thought?
Yeah.
But anyway, so I worked on that for a long time, and that was going to be the next Larry. Well, when it fell apart, and it looked like it was going to be years before I ever saw any money from that game, I kind of bailed out, and I said, you know, Ken, I've got to do some other project because I'm going to starve. This thing's never going to ship. So I backed off and let other people work on that, and I went back and started doing another Larry game, but I was screwed. I had painted myself into a corner.
Right.
What am I going to do to get him out of this thing? And so I was working on ideas and coming up with things and trying new ideas, but nothing worked. And one day I was in the hallway, and I said hello to somebody I hadn't seen for a while. She said, "What are you working on now, Larry 4? And I, like a smart ass, said, "Oh no, Larry 5. And of course I'm working on Larry 4. And then I started thinking, well, wait a minute. You know, maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's how I can get myself out of this hole I've dug. And so that's why there was never a Larry 4. So then I made a joke out of it by saying, "Oh, yeah, throughout Larry 5, you remember back to what happened in Larry 4, which, of course, was whatever I needed, some kind of a tick or something, that I would go back through there and use that. So, yeah, so anyway, there never was a Larry 4. There was never a startup, although I guess in a way, you could say that that online game that you know, that never happened could have been the fourth one. But yeah, so it ended up being a smart aleck remark that turned out to be great mind share, because the marketing people, I know when the sales team took it out to the buyers and tried to sell it, the buyers universally said, "What? Larry 5? What happened to Larry 4? And immediately that was enough to get their attention and to you know, make the game a success.
Nice.
So how long were you with Sierra?
16 years.
And how different was it from the time you started to when you were done there, like the process of getting a game out the door?
Well, because of my relationship with Ken Williams and Roberta Williams, as long as Ken was in charge, it stayed pretty much the same. I mean, we would, you know, go out and have a nice dinner and some wine and say, "Well, what do you want to do next? I don't care. What do you want to do next? I'll do this." Okay, fine. Done. Go do it. I mean, he had obviously had a lot of faith in me because I had produced a lot of games over those years, and I didn't have the same kind of grueling requirements as somebody who came in off the street. But when CUC bought out Sierra, and they had a big meeting, and they announced that, "Oh, we love Sierra, that's why we bought it, so nothing will change," which of course means everything will change.
Oh, yeah.
And the first thing they did was take Ken out of power and put him in charge of this new thing called the Internet. And they, you know, Ken, God bless him, to his honor, he took that company from nothing to the largest retailer on the internet within a year. That's hard to imagine now, but at one point, what was the name of it? New Market or something like that. The site that they built was sold more than Amazon, sold more than anybody.
Wow!
In that year, that was about 1996 or seven, I guess. You know, when things were very young. And Net Market was the name of the company.
Okay.
Yeah, you can go to the Wayback Machine and look up Net Market from that period. I think that'd be fun. Anyway, once Ken left, and they put someone in charge who I think his background had been at an oil company in Texas.
So he's well qualified.
And then he was replaced by a guy who was fresh out of MBA school, and then he was replaced by a guy who sold biscuits. He literally worked at Nabisco. You know, they went through, not surprisingly, they went through some downward spiral, and they really had trouble coming up with game ideas and shipping them. I guess they didn't have trouble coming up with the ideas. The trouble was getting them through to fruition because they weren't sure what they wanted to do. So they would spend a lot of time developing product and then throw it away.
Wow.
Which, you know, is it works a few times, but you can't keep doing that. So when Ken got taken out, I think the company had 1,200 employees. And finally, a couple years ago, after I think it was 5 years, maybe 5-6 years later, they the last five people turned off the lights and locked the door, and they moved them down to Southern California. And now Sierra is just a brand that's attached to product. There is no Sierra.
Yeah.
It's just right. A word that's stuck on a label on the outside of a package.
It's kind of a sad, and that seems to have happened to so many of the real pioneering game publishers and developers back then on the computer side.
Yeah, it happened to just about every one of them. You know, in the early days, when I first started, I remember we took like rafting trips with the whole industry. Like Broderbund sent a big bunch of people, and Synergistics sent it. They were a big game company then, and Datamost, and all these companies that you know, don't hear of anymore, a Learning Company, and all those places. You know, we all went rafting together. You know, we had parties and stuff together, and it was an amazing time.
That sounds fantastic. Industry's very different nowadays.
Well, I think the industry has gone through the same thing that Hollywood has. If you study the history of Hollywood, when it started, there were little guys with cameras, and they didn't know what the hell they were doing, and they had no tools. They couldn't edit. You know, they didn't know how to light sets. The film wasn't very, you know, the film was grainy and didn't have any much sensitivity. They had to film in broad daylight. I mean, all the same kind of things, only different, you know, that we had. But eventually, then they figured out a way to produce movies, and then they got in a big rut, and they produced similar movies over and over and over again. And it wasn't until the independent film movement, you know, really started in the 70s, I guess, that they got away from that studio look of film, and films became interesting again. And I think you're going to see the same thing. To a certain extent, you're seeing it now with internet games. A lot of downloadables and online games. You know, they don't have that same look, and I think you'll see that as well. But you got to look at it from the standpoint of the people running the companies. I mean, if you come to me and you want to do a game, and it's going to cost me $10 million to produce, and I have to spend another $10 million to market it, well, I'd be pretty hesitant too. You know, I'd say, well, you know, show me a track record, show me a proof that this thing is going to work. Well, that was never the case. I mean, what we did was try to do games that weren't out there. I remember, you know, the Police Quest series literally came about because Ken was at a racquetball, was at the gym, and ended up playing racquetball with a guy who was a former highway patrolman. Jim Walls had these great stories, and Ken said, "Well, why don't you, you know, put some of those stories down? We'll make a game out of them." That, you know, that just won't happen. That's not that can't happen.
And it was a great game too.
Oh yeah,
they were fun. They were fun.
Now, you mentioned a little bit ago about how the Sierra name is, you know, just kind of a brand name at this point. So that kind of brings up Magna Cum Laude, which you had.
You can read about that on my website, alwo.com.
Now, you had no involvement in that, right?
You can read about that on my website. It was a tough time for Sierra. They were closing down the studios that were here in Bellevue, and they were literally winding things down as that game was being developed. And so I had several. I mean, this is an odd way to say it. I guess maybe I'm coming back to the Britney Spears thing here, but several people at Sierra put out a cry for help and said, "God, Al, I wish we could get you involved in this game." And they tried their best to do that, but we never could work out any kind of arrangement. And I mean, you can see the whole email string and read the whole story about it on the site. The bottom line is that I had no involvement with it whatsoever.
That's probably to your benefit, I would say.
Yeah, I'm proud to say, and I'm proud to say that.
So,
you know, actually, I want to be fair here, because there was a lot about that game that I can understand why they did it. For example, not using Larry Laffer. I think that could have been a good decision. But, you know, when I bought the game, and I actually had to go down to the store and pay full retail for a copy of that game, which I regret right now.
There's money you'll never get back.
Yeah. But, you know, I kept thinking, okay, there's a joke here, because Magna Cum Laude, that there must be a... And I kept thinking, well, what's the joke? Why? What's the humor in that title? And I realized there wasn't any. And then I said, oh, the character's name is Larry Lovage. Okay, well, that must be some kind of joke or something, right? And no. It was a real schizophrenic game, I thought. In a lot of ways, there were scenes in that game that I would have been proud to have written. I mean, you know, just the idea that the monkey's addicted to cigarettes and, you know, and I imagine that whole thing about, that was, you know, I thought that was prime material. But then there was so much of the game that was just so weak, so badly designed that, you know, I never want to play Quarters again in my whole life after that game. And, just a lot of the crudeness of it, I think they really tried hard to... you know, I think they believed that the success of the Leisure Suit Larry games was the dirty part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think that. I never thought that. I always thought that the games were successful because of the humor.
Yeah. It was.
Yeah, that was. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Greg.
It was pretty universal. I remember at the time for anybody who was familiar with the Leisure Suit games, where it was fairly obvious that they'd missed the point of the old games where, like we've mentioned earlier in this interview, you know, it wasn't because of the dirty parts. It was just the whole take on it and the approach it took. So,
yeah,
that was a real shame.
Yeah, I think the... I don't know. This is a left field reference, but there's a show on Spike TV called MXC.
Love that right, show. Right.
You love that? Okay.
See, I thought I was the only one who knew about this.
But they just had a marathon, so I've seen a lot of those in the last week. But that show is just tremendous because it skirts the line. It doesn't have nudity. It doesn't have overt sex. It doesn't have, but it's, oh my God, has it got double entendres?
Oh,
has
the writing.
References. And just, I tell you, I watch it on TiVo because I have to pause the show in order to laugh. You don't want to laugh out loud because you're going to miss two more jokes while you're laughing at the last one. So,
absolutely.
And to me, that's the ideal that I was going for. I was going for the idea that, you know, this is silly and it's funny and it's just goofy stuff. And you know, and sure, I'm making fun of people who are obsessed with sex. Yeah, that's fun.
So
if you haven't watched MXC, you can see that on Allo. No, you can't.
Yeah, Allo.com. Yeah. You may have some trade, some copyright issues there, Al. So with Sierra and, you know, LucasArts and everybody back then was making graphic adventures in the point-and-click thing, which is a genre that's pretty much died.
Yeah.
Although,
well, I don't know that it's died so much as the good points of it have been usurped.
Okay.
You know, I think a lot of the things that we did, conversation trees and inventory manipulation and inventory usage and that kind of stuff, a lot of that stuff is now in other games. You know, RPGs do that stuff and shooters do a lot of that. So I don't know if it was, you know, there's also a big point, I believe, that adventure games were the perfect game for the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Because to use a computer back then, to be a computer owner, you had to be a puzzle solver.
Good
I
point.
Mean, how, yeah. You know, how could you manipulate your memory and config.sys and change your... I used to have a subdirectory, but I figured nobody would know what that was. I used to have a folder full of config.sys and auto-exec bat files and a batch file that would copy those based on a parameter and reboot the computer so that I could play different games.
Those were the days.
Yeah. Who the hell's going to put up with that kind of behavior? You know? And so I think solving puzzles and figuring all these obtuse things, and also typing. Think about typing. You used to type in all these different things. Well, that made sense when you sat in front of a command prompt and typed all day. That's what you did on the computer. But once, you know... I remember having this conversation with guys at Sierra saying, oh, won't it be great when a third of the country has a computer? Just think of all the games we could sell, you know, because then at the time, 5% of the country had computers. But the difference was that we were making games for the top 1 or 2% of the population. Mm-hmm. That enjoyed the guys who read Games Magazine today, the guys who, you know, solve puzzles as, you know, as for fun. That's not what's the market penetration now in computers? 75% of the population has access to a computer.
At least, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're not sitting around solving puzzles. They're going to YouTube and watching videos. You know, they're making MySpace pages. That's the right space. So I think that adventure games, like I said, I think they were the perfect medium for the 80s. But I think at this point, no, I think you'd be hard-pressed to sell an adventure game today.
Yeah,
so why are we doing this show? That's the question, then.
Because we miss them, dang it.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I do too. Know. I miss them myself. I enjoyed Monkey Island. I loved Space Quest. Those games, Steve Moretzky's stuff was just great. You know, I miss them myself.
Have you had a chance to try out the Sam & Max games they've been releasing?
You know, I looked at it. I gave it a go, and I didn't go back.
Really?
Which is not a good sign.
No.
I intended to. It's one of those things where I intended to. But I think I probably will get back to it and play them. Those guys are great.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, they're taking that kind of episodic approach to it now. You know, it's I guess maybe they're just afraid of going full steam into an adventure game because, you know, the genre is kind of petered out at this point. So maybe they're more content to taking these kind of little baby steps to get people back in.
You know, I hope it works for them. It's a great model. If it works, it would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely.
I think that's the part of it that excites me the most, really. It's just the whole skirting the marketing and the packaging ordeal that costs so much right now.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading your website and saw that you made a mention at one point on there about a few years ago you had plans for a true Larry sequel. With the subtitle Lust in Space.
Oh, well, that was the original goal once Larry 7 came out we would go. But Larry 7 came out and about the same time as my mind just went blank. The LucasArts game about the Day of the Dead. Grim Fandango. Came out about the same time as Grim Fandango, and Grim Fandango sold terribly, and that scared the people who were then in charge at Sierra, and so they said, well, maybe we should reconsider this Larry 8 game. But no, Larry 8, Larry 7 ends with Larry being taken away by a giant spaceship. And so 8 was going to start with Larry in this wonderful world. Wait, now I shouldn't be giving away this game design. What if adventure games come back?
If they did, would you be willing to actually go ahead with the game?
Oh, heck, you kidding? What's more fun than game design? Larry 8 was going to start with Larry in this wonderful 70s world where everything was 70s and it was all this disco and women and all this. And then during the course of the game, what you learned was evil female tribe, the civilization that was had earlier killed all their men and now missed them, was setting Larry up in a zoo.
Nice.
And had through various anal probes altered his mind so that they looked like these hot chicks from the 70s. And during the course of the game, you discovered that, you know, really instead of these beautiful babes, they were all these really horrible-looking aliens that you were busy impregnating. So it was a little weird, I guess.
So he went on quite the journey from, you know, just buying condoms in some sleazy town.
Yeah.
First Larry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you run out of ideas.
And surely, I mean, I can't imagine that you would have a game with Larry out in space dealing with aliens without some sort of Roger Wilco Space Quest cameo.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, that's too easy. Too natural, yeah. But anything else you have, Greg?
Unless Al, you want to pluck your site a little bit more, feel free.
What site's that?
I think it's it starts with an A.
What I want to say about my site is that when I started it, I had no idea why I was doing it. It was just that I had a lot of humor lying around that I had collected for 20 years, probably, different jokes and different things, and I thought, well, maybe I should just share this with people, and I put it up, and what I got out of it was emails, tens of thousands of emails, I don't know, maybe 100,000 email, I don't know, a lot of email from people that had bought my games and had played them, and well, I guess Maybe that's presumptuous. I got a lot of emails from people who played my games.
Yeah.
You kind of hope that they bought them.
Giving them the benefit of the doubt on that one.
Yeah, give them the benefit of the doubt. But from people who play the games and wrote me sincere letters, you know, just saying how much they'd enjoy doing them. This sounds bizarre, but it's the truth. When we did the games, somehow I didn't realize or didn't comprehend how many people were actually on the receiving end of this stuff. I mean, you got to understand, we were working our butts off, and we were working around the clock, and we were trying to turn out games in time for the next Christmas season, right? Mm-hmm. And so I never really had a feedback mechanism. You know, being a musician or performer, you stand in front of an audience, you kind of know how it's going. You know, you can tell what's happening. But with software, there was no internet, there was no email, and there was none of that. Until I put up allo.com and started getting this feedback from people, I didn't realize how much of an impact the games really had on people and how much enjoyment it had. I mean, I had these numbers, you know, I had these spreadsheets that were full of numbers and big numbers, you know, but I never equated each one of those digits to some guy sitting for hours and hours trying to figure out what in the hell do I do with the, you know, whatever it was, and then laughing at the result of it. So really what I've enjoyed most about the website has been the feedback that I've gotten from people. And, I mean, I've posted, God, thousands of emails on there that you can read. But the majority of them have just been a real blessing. I mean, I've just really that's been the best part of the whole thing. And I also want to plug a daily joke email that I do, which I cleverly named Cyber Joke 3000. you can add some kind of effect or
that's
something.
It must be hard to type out, but yeah.
But anyway, I've for the past 7 years, I've sent out two jokes every weekday morning I'm up to about, I think, 6,000 subscribers now. And wow. I don't get a cent out of it. I don't make any money on it or anything. I run it through a Yahoo group, so Yahoo puts an ad in, but I don't get anything out of it. But it's just fun for me, and I've gotten thousands of jokes from people, you know, and it's been really fun to send those jokes out now. So anyway, stop by and laugh and read about the old games, but also tell me your story and sign up for the jokes every day, and maybe I can still make you laugh.
Very cool.
Awesome.
Well, Al, thank you so much for talking to us tonight. And there's two more people here. I mean, we grew up on your games, and I know personally, Leisure Suit Larry was one of the reasons I got into gaming, mostly because of the humor. Once I figured out how to answer those first five questions.
Yeah, exactly.
Alt X, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now I know.
Yeah, now you tell us.
That would have served me much better. It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And that's our episode for this week. Thanks again to Al for giving us so much of his time. Remember, you can leave us feedback on our forum or voicemail at 713-893-8069, which is very thematic for the games we're talking about this week. You can subscribe to the Player One Podcast at playeronepodcast.com or through the iTunes Music Store. Thanks again to Phil for joining me this week.
Thank you for having me on, and just again, more thanks to Al. Really appreciate it.
Right on. CJ and Dan will return next week for our next episode. Talk to y'all then.
Bye.
You have a great radio voice.
Oh no, it's this Plantronics headset.
Ah, okay.
Why do you think I bought it, man?
Yeah.
It's true. You do have a great radio voice. You sound like you're going to be classing up our podcast.
Which wouldn't be hard to do. So.
True. So. Well,
To After Midnight here on FM 72.
Jeez, that is good.
Hope you're taking notes on this, Craig.
And now the mellow sounds of...
Oh, man.
I used to be at a late-night DJ jazz on a jazz station in California. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Oh, man, when was this?
Oh, back when they were starving for money.